Today is Friday, April 12, 2019. It is 12 o'clock, and this panel number is 4306, and the session is When the Weather is... Oginaktuk. Okay, so before we start, I just want to give you a little bit of a timeline how we run this panel. I need to do some announcements, and then I will introduce our panelists, and we'll start with the first question, and then you can submit questions, and I have to read this to you. In this Conference of World Affairs session, we will utilize both the CWA app and a note card system to receive questions from the audience. To ask a question in the app, simply select this session in the schedule, tap Q&A, and then insert and send your question. You may also raise your hand to request a note card and pencil from one of our producers, which is Heidi and Aline. Where are you?
She just had an
appointment. Oh, okay. Okay. I'll make sure that you... Oh, here she is. Heidi and Aline is under... Oh, I think she's running upstairs. Okay. You must write it legibly, and if you are a student or attending remotely, please note that this is your question. Make your question brief and to the point and indicate whether you're a student or not. So please welcome our three panelists here on the stage, which is Caroline Behi, Julian Strobe, and Michelle Deller. Give her a welcome. Welcome. So Carolina is an Indigenous Knowledge and Science Advisor to the Inuit Circuit Polar Council, ICC, in Alaska. She advises management and policy on food security and climate variability. She was the head of delegation on the conservation of Arctic flora and fauna working group under the Arctic Council. And the goal of the ICC, and I think also her goal, is making adaptive ecosystem-based decisions in the face of climate change. So welcome, Carolina, to this panel. The next panelist is Julian Strobe. She is a professor at the University College of London, so thank you very much for coming here. She was also awarded a Canadian Excellent Research Chair at the University of Manitoba. She got her PhD here at CU in geography, and the title was Greenland Climate Variability. I'm not saying the year. It's terrible. Not terrible, but I think it's terrible that they posted. She was also a researcher at the National Science and Ice Data Center. She is a renowned scientist, and her area of expertise is sea ice forecasting at seasonal, decadal, and long-term timescale. And she is a highly cited researcher and has over 80 publications. She went on field campaigns in Greenland and Arctic Ocean, and she also has given keynote addresses around the world on Arctic climate issues and informed Vice President Al Gore and congressional staff. So please welcome Julia. And our third speaker is Michelle Deller. She's the Assistant Director of Science at the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center. She got a bachelor degree in astrophysics from Harvard and a PhD from Georgia State University. She served as the public outreach lead for the Spitzer Space Telescope at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory before moving to Goddard in 2009. She's also a celebrity because she hosts she's a regular host at the Discovery Science Channel, How the Universe Works and Space's Deepest Secrets. And she also has her own podcast, so don't Google it now, on Orbital Path on public radio. So she received several high-profile awards for online science journalism and science leadership. So please welcome Michelle. Give each panelist about 5 minutes to maybe summarize or give them some ideas about this topic and what your opinion on that is. So, Carolina, please start.
Okay. Well, first I want to thank Heidi, my friend Heidi McCann, for telling me about this conference and telling the conference about us and really encouraging myself and some other colleagues to come here to share some of these perspectives with you. As was shared, I work for the Inuit Circumpolar Council. The Inuit Circumpolar Council advocates and works for the Inuit across Chukotka, Alaska, Canada, and Greenland. There's a lot of other indigenous peoples in the Arctic, but I'll just refer to Inuit because we're Inuit organization. I think the first thing to talk about is to recognize that these are Inuit homelands and that they've been there from time immemorial. And when we say time immemorial, in some places that means 13,000 years, some places it means 18,000 years, some places 10,000 years. And over that time, Inuit have always adapted. They've always taken in whatever what was happening and they adapted. They maintained their cultural integrity, and we adapt. That's what you're meant to do. The way that that's done is you follow the animals and the weather. You don't try to control them. You follow them. It doesn't mean that you don't have mitigation measures, but you don't try to control it. You have to be within this part of this environment with humility and know that you're adjusting to the animals and the weather. So some of the things that have really stand out with this changing climate is the geopolitics that go along with it. So with this changing climate has also come a huge increase in interest in the Arctic from other governments, from industry, from researchers, and a lot of people wanting to have a say in what's happening in the Arctic. And there's this fantastic cartoon from an Inuk who has this Inuk is singular for Inuit. An Inuk goes out in the snow to his mailbox that's in the middle of the ice and opens it up and says, "Huh, that's funny, still no invitation to the discussion about who owns my Arctic." And that's really what it feels like sometimes, that you're fighting to be at the table to discuss your homeland. We really need to take a huge step back from that and recognize what's happening. Because as more people come in, a large group of people that are already marginalized are being further marginalized. Not only are these Inuit homelands, Inuit also hold a lot of the solutions. Again, they've been here from time immemorial. Inuit are very innovative people. They have a lot of solutions. They pull from their indigenous knowledge, from science, from technology. They pull from all resources and have a lot of the solutions. But you would be surprised how many discussions I go to where I've heard the statement of, we have to figure out what's going on so we can tell the community how to adapt. Wow, you really don't know what you're doing. The community knows how to adapt, but there's so many regulations and there's so many international institutions that are not adapting. They do not know how to address climate change. This top-down approach is not going to get us to adaptive decision-making. It's not going to get to ecosystem decision-making. And so we really need to look to the Inuit for honest partnership. We need to look to Arctic Indigenous peoples to honest partnership to see what needs to be done. Part of these things that need to be done, though, is also the recognition of what's being done to their homelands. And so governments need to take responsibility for that. So while Inuit have a lot of solutions, it doesn't negate the governments from needing to take responsibility and provide resources to implement those solutions. That might mean stronger infrastructure. It might mean disaster relief supplies, like if there's a shipping wreck. It could mean all kinds of different things. But the government definitely needs to take a responsibility in that. That what's happening in the Arctic is greatly due from a cause of actions from outside of the Arctic. Some of these other things too, some of these innovations and some of these ways in which people need to have their voices heard and be part of the conversation, is even when we think of basic research, Inuit want to be deciding what the research questions are. They want to be helping to guide even just purely scientific research, which I never believe there is. There's always Indigenous knowledge along with this. We really want to see the Indigenous knowledge and science together. But this looks different in different places. And that's why you have to go directly to the communities, directly to the regions, and build those partnerships. But overall, this really has to do with respecting who has the authority. If you have a problem, you go to the people with the authority and with the most knowledge of how to address that problem. And that's what we need to see happen here. And the last thing I'll say about this is that some key things to really remember that this is affecting is food security. And I'll explain to you in a bit what food security means. Self-determination, human rights. And if some of you have heard me on panels before, really recognizing that not just indigenous peoples, but all of us are part of the ecosystem. We can't keep looking for solutions that thinks of this ecosystem as something separate from us. Koyana.
Thank you, Carolina. Maybe can you wait, Julian?
Yeah, it's really great to be here, and it's really great that the Arctic has been a part of this conference this year. I think that's really wonderful to see because, you know, the Arctic is one of the places on this planet that is changing so rapidly and so profoundly. And, you know, sometimes when we think about global warming and we think about the fact that the Earth has warmed globally at about, you know, 1 degree since 1900, but in the Arctic it's been warming about 2 to 3 times that. So we're looking at 2 to 3 degrees Celsius that we've risen over the last 150 years. And when we look into the future and we think about things like the Paris Agreement, where if we want to keep temperatures to 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels, so another half a degree of warming, the warming in the Arctic is going to be around 4 degrees at that point. And if we get to 2 degrees, we're looking at 7 degrees Celsius of warming in the Arctic. And this is going to have really large implications for all aspects of the climate system in the Arctic. You can think about changes in melting from the Greenland ice sheet or other small glaciers. You can think about permafrost thawing, which of course would affect all of the communities living in the Arctic, which are already facing extreme erosion and permafrost thawing that is forcing some villages to have to completely relocate in the Arctic. And then also, of course, we have the sea ice loss, and we're facing the real possibility that within the next 20 years, we will likely see an Arctic Ocean that will be ice-free in summer. And this is because that the rate of ice loss that we're seeing today in the Arctic is directly tied to how much CO2 we've put in the atmosphere. And we did a study a couple of years ago where we were able to quantify that for every gigaton of carbon we add to the atmosphere, we melt 3 square meters of sea ice. So at our current emission rates of about 35 to 40 gigatons of carbon every year, that means with an additional 700 gigatons of carbon, which is going to be probably happening in about the next 20, 25 years, the Arctic Ocean will become ice-free. So it's not so much a matter of time anymore. It's a matter of how much more CO2 we can add to our atmosphere before we'll see this transformation. And this is a profound climate shift. This is something that we haven't witnessed since humans have probably been living in the Arctic region. And I think what's really important to remember, and I like that Carolina is here, because the Arctic is home to about 1 million people. So the changes that are happening are impacting people directly. And sometimes I feel that, you know, us in lower latitudes, you know, maybe we recognize how quickly things are changing, but we're not having to experience these drastic climate shifts happening so quickly like people in the Arctic are having to do. I can give a couple examples. So, you know, you represent the Inuit culture, but there's also a lot of indigenous cultures over on the Siberian side, over in Finland and Lapland, and a lot of these people are reindeer herders. And what's been happening as we have more open ocean, we're getting sort of these intrusions of these events in wintertime when you have rain falling on snow. And when that happens, it'll refreeze and you get this really strong ice layer that's on top of that snowpack. These people that are reindeer herders, those reindeer cannot break through that icy crust, and they die. And so in 2006, for example, in 2013, you had like 30,000 reindeer die each year because they cannot access their food. And that impacts the livelihood of the people living in the Arctic. And these sort of rain-on-snow events are starting to occur more frequently in the Arctic. So I guess, I mean, one key points I want to make is that, you know, these shifts that we're starting to see, we have to start addressing not just the impacts that we're going to see in the Arctic, but it's also going to start impacting all of us down here. Everything is interconnected. And just because we're not experiencing these dramatic changes in our daily lives, like the people that are living in the Arctic are, doesn't mean that it's not starting to impact our lives as well. I mean, you can think about the polar vortex events that we had this winter in the U.S., where we had these really strong cold air outbreaks. This is likely really tied to what's been happening in the Arctic with the loss of the Arctic sea ice and the fact that the Arctic is warming twice as fast as the rest of the planet. So I think I'll leave it at that for now. And
thank you. Moving on to Michelle.
Sure. I think what I can do is kind of provide some backup to sort of explain how relevant some of the things my colleagues here are talking about. So I'm the Assistant Director of Science at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center, which is about a 10,000-person science organization run by NASA in Greenville, Maryland. And there's this, basically us and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory are the two big centers of Earth science of NASA. And it may surprise you to know that we have NASA-affiliated scientists that were actually with the lab reindeer herders in the last few years, because we understand that this is a major shift in the way the weather and the climate is working in the poles. A number of my friends are in Greenland right now as we speak, and we were wrapping up our Antarctic research campaign, of course, during our winter and their summer. But we have on the order of about 50 different science missions that concentrate on Earth science. And so even though I personally am an astrophysicist, this is not my specialty. This is a big deal for us at NASA. And although, you know, what I know about is more than like the black hole result we all saw on Wednesday, I think that the most important science NASA is doing right now is our Earth science program. And our Earth science program, while it covers many, many aspects of the Earth system, has a huge focus on the poles. Because the poles are really where we find climate change is being driven. And as has been mentioned, you know, for a relatively small degree rise average over the globe, the Arctic has a hugely accelerated rate of change. And that has to do with some very specific conditions up there. The idea of a feedback mechanism, that something keeps going faster and faster as you drive the system. You know, for example, as sea ice melts, sea ice was a protective, almost mirror-like surface on the poles of our planet, and that was reflecting sunlight back into space and cooling our planet. So the less sea ice you have, the more sunlight is absorbed by a darker ocean. The ocean gets warmer, more sea ice melts, less reflection, more heat. And so you can see that the poles are really driving what's happening with climate change. The changes at the poles are incredible. I mean, sometimes they're actually sort of hard for me to parse. One of the missions that I'm sure you're familiar with is GRACE, the Gravity Recovery and Climate Experiment. And GRACE is a mission, interestingly enough, it doesn't take any images, it doesn't actually look down. It's only two satellites. They're connected by a microwave beam. They're about 150 miles apart from each other. And the beam actually measures the distance between these two satellites. As they go over areas of increasing gravity, they respond to the gravity individually, and there are tiny little shifts. And so we do this little dance over the entire planet. And one of the things that just amazes me is that the ice sheet of Greenland, so just Greenland, just that one area in the Arctic, for the last 15 years has been losing an average of 200 billion tons of mass a year. And that rate may be increasing. That's something that we're actually working on right now, is to see if the rate itself is changing. So 200 billion tons a year just from Greenland. There's other places, you know, that are also losing huge amounts of mass in the Arctic for the ice melt. But, you know, that's going to translate into a very, very noticeable ocean level rise across the entire planet. So, you know, what happens in the Arctic is certainly not isolated. The weather all over the planet is getting stranger because what used to keep the jet streams kind of locked in place was the temperature difference between the poles and the equatorial regions. The temperature differential locked the jet stream in place. Now the poles are warming so fast compared to the other regions, the jet stream is wobbling. And we're going to have more turbulence, more extreme weather. There have been some cases where the jet stream has wobbled so much, it's almost caught all the way down to the equator. And we're like, you know, what does that mean? Are you going to mix the air from different seasons, from the different hemispheres of the Earth? So the weather will continue to get more extreme. I mean, as you put more energy into the system, you will have bigger and bigger variations, colder and hotter, drier and wetter. And this is the future that we're facing. There's another aspect that NASA does. We actually do long-term climate modeling. And this is where, this is conjectural, right? I mean, there's a lot of scientific argument as to which things force the climate most. Is it carbon dioxide? Is it methane? You know, there's a lot of scientific research right now on what's going on. But we're beginning to be skeptical that we're going to be able to keep the average temperature rise to 2 degrees. That was sort of one of the more, you know, local goals. And we're starting to look at and see what a 4-degree temperature rise means for our planet. And this is something that will not happen very quickly. This will happen in terms of centuries. But, you know, this is something that historically is going to be a giant shift coming up in the next couple hundred years. Interestingly enough, the polar regions may become major population centers. As the ice melts and certain parts of our planet around the equator become uninhabitable, literally uninhabitable, the Middle East, Israel, you know, all of those places are going to be places you will have to go to in a spacesuit in some cases. And, you know, we're looking at some maximum temperatures of 170 degrees, according to our models. So, you know, what do you do when the entire population there has to migrate? Places like Antarctica, West Antarctica, places like Greenland, Northern Canada, you know, these may be places that people start to build cities in. So the Arctic may be in for a massive cultural shift, as well as just simply, you know, a geologic one. So NASA's looking into all of that, and the Arctic science that these people are doing is absolutely paramount to all of our lives.
Thank you. So as our questions come in, please submit your questions either to the note cards or online. So we have two questions that are related. One question is, do we know why the Arctic heats more faster than the mid latitudes? And then even if we would react to CO2 emissions, what would be the consequences, or how fast will the poles melt?
So Michelle touched on that, but it's basically because the Arctic is mostly covered by snow and ice. And so once you remove that reflective cover, so the land will start warming up, the oceans will start warming up. And for example, what we really see right now in the Arctic is that the really amplified warming in the Arctic compared to mid-latitudes is most pronounced in the autumn and winter. And the reason why this is because the Arctic sea ice has been the thing that's been changing the most profoundly in terms of losing its reflective cover on the ocean. And so the ocean is gaining all this heat in the summer that used to just be reflected back out to space. But before the ice can form again in winter, the ocean has to release all that heat back out to space. And so you get this really strong amplified warming signal that we're seeing develop in the autumn and winter. And so when I think about even just global warming, it's very seasonally dependent. So the warming in those seasons is much, much larger than we see, for example, in summer, when all the heat is just going into melting the sea ice and it keeps air temperatures around freezing anyways. But, you know, it's interesting, like when we think about the role of CO2 in this, I mean, obviously there's two things happening in our climate system. You have this anthropogenic background warming that is affecting our climate, and then you also have natural climate variability. And the thing is, we don't have another planet where we can run some sort of experiments to see what would happen if we just keep adding more greenhouse gases. So we do rely a lot on climate models to help us understand, you know, what would happen if we start increasing our CO2 concentrations. And when we do those kinds of experiments, we could probably say that about 60% of the ice loss we're seeing today is a direct result of increases in greenhouse gases, and the other 40% is probably also a result of changes in just natural climate variability. But the thing that's also sobering about this is that what we find is that the pace of ice loss that we're seeing in the Arctic today is faster than what our climate models have been forecasting. So back in 2007, we did a study, and we found that we were about 30 years ahead of where sort of even our worst-case climate models were telling us. And so it makes you wonder, you know, I mean, we trust these models. They're good tools in helping us understand how the climate system functions, but, you know, there might be missing certain feedbacks, or they're not strong enough to really simulate what we're seeing in today's world, which is why we also then started just looking at the relationship directly with CO2, and that's how we found this very strong linear relationship with the sea ice cover, and it allowed us to be able to forecast at what sort of threshold of CO2 we can actually go to before we would become ice-free. And the 1.5 degree sort of Paris Agreement, which I know we're not going to reach, we're definitely going to go probably over 2, at that point, the Arctic Ocean will become ice-free in August and September. Now, what I do find, I mean, that's not a very happy message, but I also do find that it's not an irreversible process. So we do also have learned from our climate models that if you were to stop the CO2 emissions and the climate starts to cool back down, the sea ice will come back. It's not that if we lose it all, that it's impossible to bring it back. So there's some hope in that. But it also means we have to really get aggressive about reducing our CO2 emissions and also probably thinking of solutions to pull more carbon out of the atmosphere.
Thank you. Before we continue the science question, I want to know from Carolina, can you give us some examples how current, like, indigenous people are suffering under a changing climate or changing in weather and climate pattern, and what kind of measures you might suggest that we can go forward in the next 10, 20 years?
That's a really good question. I don't know.
But maybe you can give us some examples.
Okay. All right. I think I have to go back again to explaining that an ecosystem, and when we talk about these things, that you can't just talk about climate change as in the sea ice isn't there. You have to really talk about how that's connected to the rest of the ecosystem, that you really have to appreciate the relationships that are held between the people, the animals, the water, the ice, and then the politics and the policy of all of it, and how many different value systems are going into the decisions that are being made. Not just the knowledge system, so there's a problem that it's only science that is informing these decisions, but it's also a lot of values, a lot of different people's value systems that are informing these decisions. So in thinking about that, we have to think about one of the things that we talk about is food security. And food security is not just nutrients or calories. It's also culture. It's also stability. It's availability. It's accessibility. And it's also decision-making power and management. It's this entire picture that we're talking about. All of those pieces are needed in order to have food security. So some things that are happening with the change in unpredictable weather, with the climatic variability, is a lot of uncertainty of what is going to happen and when it happens. So some of that, the response that comes from those different value systems sometimes end up in direct conflict to Inuit value systems in decision-making processes. So for example, if you go to get salmon, the weather has to be right to process the salmon. Otherwise, it's not okay for you to take the salmon because you can't waste. We're told you never take more than you need. And when you say you never take more than you need, that means that your freezer's empty in the spring. You know, it means that you've not wasted any part of the animal, that you've shared, that you have respected that animal. So with increase in climatic variability, we're seeing precipitation in places that that wasn't there at that time. So all of a sudden we're seeing rain in May, and you can't dry fish in the rain because it'll mold. Or the next day the sun might be low, which means it's really hot, and that means the fish is going to cook instead of dry, and it won't keep as long. So you can't go get the fish. But the regulations might say, you need to go fishing now because there's a bunch of fish in the river. That's a complete conflict to the indigenous knowledge. It's a complete conflict to what we understand to conserving the salmon and to adjusting to the animals and the weather. So that's the type of thing that I mean when you have to look at this entire picture as one, all of these different pieces that go in there. And when you say, oh, how are the Inuit responding to climate change? You have to consider all of those things. Another example is from a couple years ago. The ice is moving in different ways now because the currents are moving in different ways. The prevailing winds are coming from different directions. People are getting hit by storms consecutively in a way that hasn't been told from the stories. And so people have to adjust to that. Well, a couple of years ago, one of our islands, who are walrus hunters, the shorefast ice slammed up against the island because the wind was coming from a different direction. And it blocked access to the walrus, so nobody could get walrus. And then this was the first time in history that anybody on the island had ever gone a winter without having, sorry, from the people that were on the island, not in the history of the island, gone without walrus. That loses all of their food. But I want you to remember again that food isn't just nutrients and calories. It's also feast, it's learning, it's this social interaction, it's this relationship between people and the walrus. And that's really important to recognize that part too. Or another part, I could just keep giving you examples forever, but I'll just give you one more. Another part are there's different whales coming, and they're coming at different times. Communities are some communities are just adjusting the timing that they go whaling. You know, we use this word seasons in a different way. Different places have a different number of seasons, and they're focused on how you're going to process your food. So some places might have 3 seasons, some places might have 7 seasons. So some whaling communities are adjusting to move to a different season for when the whales are migrating through. But again, there's different whales. And people are having to go further away from home to get different types of food. And safety is becoming a larger issue. So you need to be, if there's different whales coming near shore, you need to be able to respond. Because something else that we're taught is that the animals give themselves to you. So if an animal is giving itself to you, you need to be able to take that animal and be respectful and use it to feed your community. But the international regulations don't respect that. They don't understand that because they don't understand what the indigenous knowledge is saying. They don't understand that in the community of Utqiagvik, they're never going to take more than 3 whales in one day because they can't take more than they need. They can't waste it. They're not commercializing it. They're using it to feed their families. Okay, I hope that gives you kind of a picture of how all these pieces have to go together when we're having this kind of conversation.
Another question for Michelle. So we have one question, and it is Is there any research so far in preventing warming beyond reducing CO2? If not, are we prepared for the results of warming in our oceans, and without a proper ocean ecosystem, will we struggle to survive?
Yes. Oh my God, yes. There's research being done as to how we might artificially cool the climate, and quite honestly, there's a lot of scientists at NASA that are quite scared about this. Some people are suggesting launching huge amounts of basically inert pollutants into the atmosphere, you know, aerosols, particles. And this is something that we observe as a real fact. If a big volcano erupts, I mean, classically Mount Pinatubo dropped global temperatures for a couple of years after that eruption. There's more particles in the atmosphere. The atmosphere basically reflects light more. It sort of blocks the sunlight, and that will drop the temperatures. The one thing that this does not address at all is increasing carbon dioxide levels. And like this question has said, carbon dioxide is absorbed into the ocean, and the oceans are becoming more and more acidic. And that's another thing that we measure. It's one thing that we do research on, even from space, that can kind of interest you. Phytoplankton has, you know, trouble living in different sort of acidic environments. Things like diatoms, the little things that have calcium shells. Their shells are dissolving before they really have a chance to form. So, you know, you can actually see from space by the color of the water how healthy the algae is and the life is in that. And that's, we've been tracking those changes. So I believe there was a mention of maybe someday we will have technologies that will scrub carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and somehow sequester it, you know, put it into a safer form that perhaps we can bury, or, you know, who knows. The Earth has a lot to teach us from its history. I mean, one of the things is that we're actually in a relatively low carbon dioxide era, you know, in the history of the Earth. And amazingly, that had to do with the formation of the Himalayan mountains. When India collided into Asia, a lot of rock that used to be below the surface of the Earth was exposed in these big mountains. And over hundreds of millions of years, the rock weathered, combined with carbon dioxide. And that sucked enough carbon dioxide out of our atmosphere that we've been naturally dropping for quite a while. So, you know, this is a really interesting shift in what sort of the Earth has been doing, just in terms of, we would call it paleoclimate, climate of hundreds of millions of years ago. So, you know, the Earth has these variations. And, you know, I like this theme of adaptation, right? Life has adapted, people have adapted, cultures have adapted. You know, this is not just saying we're all going to die and it's all doom and gloom. We have some serious adaptation to get to start. So we may find technologies that will scrub carbon dioxide. The scale of it is kind of daunting. I mean, maybe other people could comment on what technologies might actually work for this. But the one that has us a little bit scared is people think they're going to solve the problem of warming by darkening the atmosphere. And how will international treaties deal with this? Say China decides to do it unilaterally. What do we do then? So, I mean, there's some really interesting geopolitical problems, because, yes, I mean, that might actually drop the global temperature, but it won't solve the underlying problem in the slightest.
Thank you. I have another two questions for Carolina. In many indigenous cultures, areas and processes are protected by being labeled sacred. What label used in our current culture would be applied to a sensitive area that will have the same effect? And follow-up question is, how can we at lower regions or latitudes support your voice, culture, or future?
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Those are two very good questions and very related to the work that ICC does actually internationally. So when people say sacred areas, it means something different than just protected area. Okay. So I think what you're talking about is maybe some protected kind of areas. And I think that Inuit and at least all the indigenous peoples I know in the Arctic, they have areas that they have different behaviors around at different times of the year. And this is responsive to the animals. So for example, there's a certain time that it gets very hot and there's a lot of mosquitoes and the caribou need to go to the coast to find refuge. They need this refuge not just for their physical well-being but for their mental well-being also. You can't go take the caribou at that time. So that's based off of a time and a season and being responsive to the animals. It's not putting static time and creating a protected area that you're meant to stay out of. And this has to do with that value, kind of value systems we talked about. And a lot of those initiatives for protected areas have this type of, I'm not saying it's a bad value system, but it's under this value system that you stay away from that area, that you want to preserve something. But for us, that means you're not recognizing your relationship to that area. Here, we have to recognize our relationship to that area. And again, humans are part of this ecosystem. Cultural, dance, language, all of those pieces are part of this ecosystem. The animal's health is as dependent on the humans as the human's health is dependent on those animals. It's all very interconnected. And so again, you have to follow the animals and the weather. You don't control them. You don't tell them what to do. You be responsive to them. So if the caribou need refuge, you leave them alone. You know, there's more orcas coming up into the Arctic, and they're chasing other animals. So another example is if orcas are chasing the beluga upriver, you don't get the beluga because they're stressed. It's not for you to stress them more. Another time, the beluga might be presenting itself to you upriver, and then you can take it. But it's very much based on those seasons, not a structure set thing in time. So when I think about how could indigenous peoples be supported, it would be by understanding those different value systems and supporting those value systems. Because a lot of regulations, a lot of policy come from lobbying. A lot of lobbying comes from people with money, industry or environmental organizations, people that have their own agenda, which is fair enough. I 100% have my own agenda. It's no secret. But here, this is Inuit homeland. They have a value system that's been being applied, and it's being pushed aside in order to be responsive to other people's value systems. Another example of this is tourists coming up. A friend of mine told me he got a letter after some tourists came up, very angry that her holiday had been destroyed because she saw a bird being shot. It's okay that she feels that way. It's not okay that she wants to impose that value system on Inuit. And that's what's been happening, right, through the history of the relationship between the government and indigenous peoples, is imposing one value system onto the other. And we should really recognize how that gets exacerbated through all of this climate change, all of these changes that we're talking about. Thank you.
Back to the effects, Julian, this one question. What would an increase of 1 degree over the next 20, 30 years have an effect on, and how does it compare to an increase of 3 or 4 degrees warming?
So I guess that would depend on if that's global warming or if that's just another 1 degree of Arctic warming. If it's 1 degree more of global warming, then you've already reached that threshold where you won't have any sea ice in the Arctic Ocean. And, you know, when I think about climate change and what I think about people should be mostly concerned about, it's going to be changes in sea level, which will impact millions of people worldwide, and it's changes in our precipitation patterns. Because, as Michelle was discussing a little bit, was that, I mean, the temperature difference between the equator and the poles is what drives our large-scale ocean and atmospheric circulation patterns. And so we're altering that by warming up the Arctic faster than we're warming the mid-latitudes and more faster than we're warming the equator. And so we're seeing these changes in the jet stream. It's actually moving slower than it used to, which means that any weather that you're having, whether it's dry or wet or hot or cold, will persist for longer in one place. And so we've seen this increase in persistence of extreme weather events. And some of these weather events, I mean, they just have huge impacts on our homes, on livelihood. For example, people probably don't realize, but in 2010, the Russian heat wave killed more than 56,000 people. And that didn't really make the news a whole lot, especially, I think, here in the U.S., but that was a massive event that killed a lot of people. And so our lives are directly tied to these extreme weather events, and these are increasing in frequency and also duration. And a large part of this, as scientists are trying to unravel what is driving these changes in extreme weather events, the Arctic is part of that equation. And we can't ignore that what's happening in the Arctic isn't starting to influence our large-scale weather patterns. So people may not realize, but the CIA actually has a task force on climate change to deal with some of these issues. So, for example, they're very worried about political instability, for example, in the Middle East. with water supply from the Himalayas, for example, which is changing quite dramatically as well, geopolitical instability in the Arctic with what Russia is doing these days. I mean, they just did some maneuvers in the Norwegian Sea, I think yesterday, where they did a bunch of military tactical movements in that region. They have more than 30 icebreakers, and the U.S. only has two, for example. So there's a lot of different sort of things that are going to be happening, but I think food security, which Caroline has already mentioned, but the changes in precipitation patterns, where the rain is going to fall, when it falls, is going to hugely affect food security around the globe. And when we look at these sort of climate model forecasts, for example, of what's going to happen to growing food, for example, if you look at the major corn producers, which is the Ukraine, France, the U.S., these are going to all of these regions are going to suffer pretty much at the same time, huge reductions in their food production because of climate change. And that feeds millions of people, as well as animals. And so I think what I worry about, if I think about these changes in temperature and what it's going to mean, it's going to be sea level rise, and it's going to be where the rain is going to fall and how that's going to impact our food security.
Thank you.
So I have another question for all of you. The question is, how much effort are indigenous people, scientists, and policymakers putting into preparing now for Arctic warming as opposed to working towards reducing the climate change? So maybe, Carolina, you can talk about Arctic region, and then maybe two of you can talk about a little bit more globally and maybe some of the political discussions. Carolina.
Sorry, what is the question?
How much effort are indigenous people putting into preparing now for Arctic warming or warming?
I'm not sure how to answer this question. There's a lot of different processes, I guess. There's some Inuit industry. I suppose they're looking to the future of how to maintain their industry without affecting Inuit way of life. Inuit have their own way of making trade-off decisions, right? And so I'm sure that they're preparing in those ways. They're doing things like phasing out heavy fuel oils. Some of our organizations, like the Makovic Corporation in Eastern Canada, has developed a 100-year plan. They're a corporation. This really has to do with that trade-off decision kind of making of ensuring that maintaining their economy doesn't come at the cost of affecting your way of life. Right? Other ways is... This is ICC trying to increase the political and intellectual space for Inuit for the negotiations that are happening, being involved in things like the UN Forum on Climate Change and the Paris Agreements. Our job, my primary job, is being involved in those international negotiations at the Arctic Council and the UN. So I suppose those are ways that we're preparing. At a community level, things go down even more specifically. So, for example, in one community, children are being taught again how to have a taste for a certain type of river water because the ice isn't thick enough to be getting the water from there. And so they're teaching children to have a taste for that. The reason why it's a little bit of a challenging question for me to answer is because this is something that would always be happening even if we weren't talking about climate change, because you're always adjusting. And so you would always be thinking, oh, the children are going to need to get water from there. Let's make sure they have a taste for it so that they continue to get water from there to stay healthy. And then also really about those discussions and about how research is happening. So all of us see a need for more information to better be prepared of how to make these decisions. And that means we need equity in the way that research is happening, that we're being guided from our communities on that part of it. Yeah, I think that there's a lot of little examples, but I think overall the point is that there's 165,000 Inuit and hundreds of thousands of other indigenous peoples in the Arctic, and we're all working collaboratively together to come from different directions because we have this whole picture to address.
Thank you. Maybe we can go ahead. Maybe I can pass on this question, like how much effort are we putting into or preparing for global or Arctic warming?
How much effort are we putting into this? I mean, I don't know if I feel like we're putting in, I don't think we're putting enough effort in at the moment. I mean, we're not going, I mean, the current climate commitments from different countries, we're not going to reach these targets that we've set for ourselves. I mean, I think that's becoming very clear, and I don't think we are doing enough. And then you think about this country and its leadership at the moment, and if you think about the world's number one emitters of CO2, China's number one, the U.S. is number two, and then followed by the EU, and then followed by India. So these are the countries that are responsible for these massive changes that we're starting to see in our climate system. And when you don't have a leadership to address this and try to, at least in this country, try to change our reliance on fossil fuels and trying to do innovative technologies to, you know, help reduce our carbon footprint. And it's really interesting, because I was teaching about this in my class not too long ago, just looking at globally how much CO2 per person each country has. And the U.S. is like 16,500, I can't remember the exact units of carbon that we emit, but in Mali it's 0.5. So, you know, there's a huge disparity in how we live. And in the U.K., where I live, it's about 5,000 units of carbon. And so, you know, the way we run our lives here, we're huge carbon consumers. I mean, I myself am as well, by flying all the time. I mean, my flight from London to Denver, I probably melted 5 square meters of sea ice just based on my CO2 emissions from that flight. So we need leadership, and we need guidance on how to change our communities, how to change our energy reliance from fossil fuels. And right now, I don't think we're doing enough. I mean, there's localized groups that are doing quite a bit, and there's certain countries that are doing quite a bit. But globally, I think at the moment we're falling quite short.
I guess, you know, one of the things we talked a little bit about how if you stop the carbon dioxide emissions and help them drop, a lot of the sea ice will recover, and that's definitely true. There are other bodies of ice that don't quite respond that quickly. It's sort of like trying to turn an aircraft carrier. And, you know, in the case of some of the large land ice things that we see, like I mentioned Greenland, we also have very large glaciers in Antarctica that are beginning to melt. There's this pesky little thing called heat capacity. And it's a physics and a chemistry thing where you basically add heat to a system for quite a while before it starts to change. You know, you can put an ice cube on a table, it's not going to start melting immediately. It's going to warm up for a little while, then it will start to melt. But how do you stop the ice cube from melting once it starts to melt? That's a problem. You need to actually somehow refrigerate it, and that's impossible at these scales. So, you know, one of the things I think that, you know, we're trying to emphasize to people is again, as I said, I mean, it's not that we're talking about the end of civilization here, but there will be a necessary adaptation. We have bought ourselves decades, if not centuries, of change just from what we've already done, the energy we've already dumped into the oceans, dumped into the ice. So there will be no way to change this like that. You know, I mean, tomorrow, if for some reason we decide to have no carbon emissions at all, you know, like that's going to happen, you still will have change for quite a long time. So, you know, these systems don't change immediately. And there was a little bit of a talk about how the CIA has a task force on climate change. They certainly do, and NASA advises them, and so does the Pentagon. And so our military and intelligence leaders are definitely preparing for this. And, you know, one of the things that we're helping them do is try to get an estimate of how many refugees are going to be produced by this, specifically ocean level rise. I mean, there's a lot of other ways you're going to get refugees, but I think, you know, by the year 2060, and that's not that far off, the estimates now are about 250 million people are going to be displaced by ocean level rise. And we've never seen that much, that large of human migration before. So, you know, one of the things we need to start doing, I need to learn more about this. I don't know many details about this, but I've heard recently that New Zealand is beginning to form treaties with people in low-lying Pacific islands to slowly and logically get people over to New Zealand. New Zealand is a nice, steep, you know, landmass. There's room for a lot more people in New Zealand. We need to start moving people, and that's... How do you tell? How do you tell the governments of the world that we're all going to have to work together to do this? And so, you know, I mean, we are definitely in for some very interesting geopolitical times. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is something that you and your children will deal with. I mean, it also, I mean, if you saw the keynote speaker at the beginning of the conference, the idea of loving a problem, right? Launching yourself into this and finding out how we're going to adjust to this. We will have to adapt. Things are going to change.
Following up on this, we have another question. How can we help give the Inuit a stronger voice in policies for global warming, and how can we create more room for them to be included in the bigger picture?
Uh-huh.
Well, I think it's what role do you play? If you're a researcher, we have all kinds of actions that you could be doing to be supporting Inuit. And that really has to do with having true partnerships. If you are a person that works in policy, you can be writing to your leadership within this state itself to be supporting Indigenous rights and Inuit way of life. You could be supporting polluter pay policies. You could be looking at adaptation policies for decreasing CO2. The thing we see the agencies getting sued from environmental groups a lot is them not responding to things like loss of sea ice. And then they use animals like walrus or polar bear to have the lawsuit and to say that they're not meeting their mandate, but really they're trying to do something to address CO2. But by taking that action, they're really just taking the food away from and the relationship away from Inuit, because then all of a sudden there becomes a risk of a different type of regulation on hunting walrus or interaction with polar bear. And so understanding what those actual actions are and addressing those connections by talking to your leadership or through your actions would be really supportive of Arctic Indigenous peoples. And then just being more aware, I think, more aware of what's actually happening in the Arctic. I can really appreciate, I really don't know what's going on in Florida most of the time. So I can really appreciate not knowing what's happening in the Arctic. But there's a bit of a responsibility to educating ourselves a little bit about who the people are, what is their way of life, and what's happening in the Arctic. Because the things that we're doing in other places of the world are affecting the life in the Arctic, not just the people, but the animals also, right? And this does play out in policy. And so whether you're a researcher or a citizen, you have avenues to the people that are making decisions. Thank you.
I just want to follow on with one quick comment, and that is that I have been at least seeing at scientific conferences, or even we had this Arctic ministerial recently in Berlin, or I've had UNESCO-funded meetings talking about Arctic sustainability, and you're definitely seeing the Indigenous peoples being more represented at these meetings, at higher level meetings. And I think that's been really great to see, because as a scientist, you know, we have our talks and we talk about the science that's happening, but you haven't always had the Inuit voice at these scientific conferences. But I'm starting to see that more and more, which I think is one way that even as scientists we can start better understanding the value systems of the Inuits and what they need. And I also think what they have is such a valuable resource. So if I think about our satellite observations, we have, 40 years of really good observations of what's been happening in our climate system. But as Carolina mentioned, the Inuit have been there for millennia. And so their knowledge on, how the weather was or where the ice was, at the time of year they would go hunting, what the ice was like at that time, that's really valuable information that can also help us as scientists go back further in time and understand, how are the changes that we're seeing today in this more modern observational period, how does that relate to changes that have gone back thousands of years? And I think so their knowledge is so key in our scientific understanding of climate change. And I think that's a point that we really need to really remember and find other mechanisms where we can try to incorporate their Indigenous knowledge in our science.
Could I add just one more thing, too? Yeah. Thank you. It just made me think, too, that it's also really important to remember that there's not one solution for everything. And so one of those institutional changes that we need is that there's kind of this homogenous approach where you think, I'm going to write this formula and it's going to fit across the globe. And it's not true. There's, like I mentioned, Inuit have their own trade-off mechanisms for making decisions. So something that might work here doesn't mean it's going to work there. And so it's really important to respect that there's these different ways of thinking, different ways of doing, of coming up with solutions, and to have that voice at the table.
Thank you. We are shifting gears here a little bit. There are several questions that came in to the fact is that what are the uncertainties in the research concerning Arctic warming or global warming? Or in, phrasing it in a different word, is that in climate change deniers, what are the points that they could pick up where the science does not have the supporting data?
So I want to relate some things. I find this really quite interesting. So I think, you know, as scientists, we really do understand the role of greenhouse gases in helping warm the planet. We have really good satellite observations about how much outgoing long-wave radiation there's being emitted back out to space, and that's been changing over time as CO2 is increasing the atmosphere and has been absorbing more heat. So we have really good understanding of the role of CO2 in climate change and also its role in global warming. So I think that part is not in doubt with the client, with the scientists that I work with or even that I've always interacted with. I don't think that there's any lack of consensus on this. We're not as certain as exactly how, for example, changes in precipitation patterns will play out. So the warming in climate models, when you take away the greenhouse gases or put them back in, those are very robust. They're robust across many, many different climate models and robust in our observations. Where the models kind of fall apart a little bit in terms of the robustness is what is that going to mean for weather, for example, in the America Southwest? A lot of these models suggest that it's going to dry out and you're going to have less precipitation and less snowfall, but they're all over the place and they're not as robust in terms of exactly how our weather patterns are going to change in the future. But I have a colleague of mine who lives up in New Hampshire. He's a social scientist, and he's always polling people in New Hampshire about the understanding of Arctic change. Even just simple questions, do you know where the North Pole is? And a lot of people don't even know that it's in the ocean and it's not on land, for example. And then he asks them, you know, how confident are you in climate change? And do you know if the Arctic sea ice is disappearing or staying the same? And of course, those questions definitely seem to fall along party lines quite a bit. But one of the things, so there seems to be less certainty perhaps that warming has been driving the sea ice loss, but when you ask those people, is what's happening in the Arctic affecting your weather? They're more confident that that is happening. And that's very ironic because that's where the scientists are still trying to piece everything together because we're not exactly sure. I mean, if you're talking about the New Hampshire area, the northeastern part of the U.S., is the climate change happening there a direct result of what's happening in the Arctic? Those are the kinds of things that we're still trying to better understand, and we have less confidence or less, you know, ability to say, yes, for sure, this is why. Whereas we're very confident that greenhouse gases have been driving the Arctic sea ice loss or increased Greenland melting or permafrost thaw, we know that that is happening as a result of greenhouse gases. So public understanding of where the robustness is really quite different sometimes than what the scientists understand. And, you know, part of that, I think, is down to the way media reports things and definitely focusing on extreme events. When, you know, when you think about climate change, what you're really thinking about is these long-term changes. I mean, you have this temperature record that's going up, but along that you have ups and downs, you have these wiggles, and that's your natural climate variability. And I can't tell you whether this year is going to be hotter than next year. I can tell you that we're going to keep on this upward trend. I can tell you that the sea ice is going to continue to decline over time. I can't tell you if this summer is going to be less ice than we had in 2012, which was our record low sea ice. But sometimes our media focuses so much on these extreme events, and it's really the long-term changes that is what's linked to climate change, and that's the message we should get across better, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I really can't, you know, agree enough. I mean, the idea that we understand how our atmosphere works entirely, I've got some news for you. We don't. It's an incredibly complex system. It's linked to the land. It's linked to the oceans. It's linked to the cycles of the Earth's orbit around the sun. There's many, many contributors to exactly how the climate works. And I think scientists, you know, our profession, we sort of obsess over the error bars and uncertainties because that's where our research centers on. So, you know, we can't tell you exactly how fast the ocean level is going to rise. The somewhat depressing thing is every time we estimate it, it turns out to be rising faster than we predicted. So, you know, I mean, there really is, you know, there's only a certain amount that we understand. There's no uncertainty whatsoever that the climate is changing extremely rapidly. Historically, in the history of the Earth, aside from a giant asteroid impact that takes out the dinosaurs, we haven't had a climate change this fast, really. It's very, very fast. And it is absolutely linked to human activity. I mean, that's something that I can say unequivocally. So, but then we get into the questions as to what are the most important drivers. You know, we have a forestry group at NASA that's showing, I believe, that, you know, deforestation may have more impact on climate change than all of our transportation emissions put together. So, you know, there are things where now we need to get scientifically honest about, you know, what really is affecting the climate, and we certainly don't understand what the biggest contributors are yet. How much methane will be released from the permafrost as it melts? We don't know. We're measuring it. But, I mean, these are things that we have to estimate. So there is certainly error. There is certainly uncertainty in how this is going to unfold, absolutely. But as was just said, the general trend over time is completely established.
So I just kind of wanted to add to a little bit different than the uncertainty, but then in listening to you guys, it does remind me that this is where we have a good opportunity to be bringing in Indigenous knowledge, right? So this is where Indigenous knowledge and science can aid in understanding not only the connections that are there, but also how they're changing. So even within modeling, you know, determining what variables need to go into that model to understand what kind of changes are happening. Elders have shared with us that even mostly through the late 50s and the 60s, they started trying to tell people that the climate was changing, that something was different. There was one village where they saw rain for the very first time. There had never been rain there before, and this created ice in a different way. So these types of things have been trying to be communicated for a long time. Or another friend says they get frustrated because researchers will come in with a question that they already have an answer to. And if they would stop and develop the question together, they could jump forward a couple steps, right? Because Indigenous knowledge doesn't have all those answers either, but we really have a lot of room here to be bringing the two of them together to have a much stronger understanding of these systems, but also understanding that a lot of the Indigenous knowledge comes in these concepts, that it's this understanding that it's not a constant. And one of the things that drew me to science, of me liking science, was that it wasn't meant to be a constant, but it seems to be treated that way all the time, at least in media or just in general conversations.
As we're wrapping up this panel, can you maybe, all of you, just give an idea of, like, what do you think people could do? Because we're talking about, like, governmental change and implementation and policy, so this is one way, so we all need to vote. But can you also just maybe give an idea of what people could do on a grassroots basis or individual people could do? What recommendation you can give? I don't know who wants to start.
That's a damn good question. I mean, seriously, it's one of these things we keep getting asked, you know, what should I individually do? And one person can't influence this all that much. It's so complicated. I mean, just the other day, you know, I try never to use, you know, one single-use plastics, and so I have my wonderful, you know, National Public Radio tote bag, and someone did the research, you have to use that 20,000 times to actually make up for the plastic, you know, it's actually better to have plastic bags. It's like, oh. I think one of the things is don't go chasing after all of it. Obviously, there are better things to do. One of the things, I'm kind of going back to, you know, one of my personal heroes, Buckminster Fuller. We can make sort of massive cultural changes and still have a very good standard of living. We're not talking about destroying, you know, everything that we do in our culture. There are ways we can actually live with very low carbon emissions very easily. And I think this has kind of been the lie that's been told to us. I mean, with things like solar energy and then perhaps a return of some nuclear energy, you know, highways that can actually charge your cars as you drive on them, these are all possible. I mean, when I think about adapting to climate change, you know, I remember the tremendous upheaval and global effort that World War II was, right? I mean, that's not a good thing, World War II. But, you know, people all around the planet changed what they were doing. Factories changed what they were making. People changed what they were consuming. You know, people changed the culture because of this conflict. And, I mean, that's in living memory, right? We have people who still remember World War II. My husband was born just a couple years after the rations ended in England. He remembers not having a lot of food. So, you know, this is in current memory that we can shift things a lot. And when I think about responding and adapting to climate change, I'm thinking about a World War II level of effort. It's something that we can do. It's not going to be easy. I'd much rather it be collaborative than in terms of conflict. And that's what worries us. You know, as different parts of the world are affected more than others, China and India, for example, will really take it on the chin, a little more than North America will, we think. You know, will that start wars as opposed to people working together to solve this? So we're looking at it. I believe, you know, we have to prepare ourselves culturally for that shift more so than any specific thing that you're going to be doing with plastics.
So I absolutely agree with everything you said. I think one thing we also really need to do is we need to improve climate literacy and energy literacy. And that really comes down to the education at the young levels, all the way up to colleges, and just improve our understanding of climate processes, of energy solutions. And I think that is one way that we can start making a lot of change is by giving people the knowledge so that they can make more informed and better decisions about how their energy consumption can change and what is possible, as well as understanding how the climate system functions better. I'm always amazed at just sometimes just the lack of education on these topics. And listening, I just actually listened the other day to John Kerry talking with the senator from Kentucky. That was unbelievable. Just like, and it really showed his lack of knowledge about climate. And so I just feel like we really need to improve that, especially in this country. I think it's true globally, but it's really interesting because whenever I fly and I sit next to somebody and they ask me what I do and I tell them what I do, and then they always say in the U.S., do you believe climate change is real? That's such a strange question. But I've never had that question in Europe, for example. They understand it. So there's something in this country that's really been a unique misinformation and disinformation campaign to really confuse people about the climate issue. And I think that's what we need to do is improve our education system so that people have the knowledge about this topic so they can make better decisions.
Yeah, I really agree with Julianne and Michelle also, but I also think that individual people can make a big difference because I think it's the way we're individually thinking. We're individually thinking about our relationship with the things around us. This communication part is really huge, but it also takes this responsibility of learning, really taking the time to learn what actually is happening so that you are sharing with each other. But then there's also these pieces, and I guess that's part of learning, is understanding how all of these pieces are connected, and that's part of what I mean by shifting the way you think. Like, really understanding how things are interconnected. Understanding my decision to come here, what does that mean connected to everything else? And that makes it possible for me to take more ownership of the decision that I've made. So when things come up, if they come up in your state, like should we have an ivory ban the way California put an ivory ban. It's very good that you have an elephant ivory ban. It's very good that that's happening. But then they tacked on to a mammoth and walrus ivory. Understanding what that means, you know, walrus ivory is a sustainable harvest resource for Inuit. Inuit are the only ones that get to use it. They make jewelry out of it. This is how they have an economy in communities where there's no other economy. This is how they make sure they never waste anything. So really understanding what the consequences are to those decisions that you're making, and really understanding that when we talk about climate change, it's not just a conversation about CO2. It's not just a conversation about it's raining or it's snowing now. It's not just a conversation about this sea ice moved here or this is causing suffering here. It's a conversation with all of those pieces. We really have to understand how all of those pieces come into play, and that the decisions we make are going to impact all of those pieces. Brianna.
Thank you. So before I let you go, I want to have each of you give us your favorite book, podcast, movie that could inform people better on climate change, Inuit life, or anything related to that.
Well, I would say the movie that I saw recently that was the most moving for me, and it was actually done by a Boulder filmmaker, is called Racing Extinction. So that was done by the same people that did The Cove, and that's an excellent movie.
Yeah. Go ahead, Michelle.
Okay. You don't have a recommendation. No,
I do.
You know, I mean, it was a much smaller scale problem, but one of the things that really gives me hope is the Montreal Protocol, which banned chlorofluorocarbons when we were depleting the ozone layer. If anybody, Montreal Protocol, yes. What has your space program done for you? I mean, so both space satellites and ground-based people at MIT and other places detected this depletion of the ozone hole. And if we had done nothing, if we had absolutely just ignored it, our climate models that had NASA say that we probably would have destroyed the ozone layer, pretty much all of it, by 2070. And in that case, you wouldn't be able to grow many crops outside, you know, people, livestock. I mean, that would have been a global catastrophe. And people did actually band together, and they changed it, they made it. I mean, this is a much smaller, more focused problem, I get that. But remember, we can do this. I mean, it is not impossible that we can work together. So there's a number of different, if you Google NASA World Avoided, you will find podcasts, articles. I believe there's a book by a man named Paul Newman who works at Goddard Space Flight Center. And you'll hear the story of how we found the ozone hole, figured out what was going on, ran to the United Nations, you know, and the story continues because now we find that China is, specifically is producing chlorofluorocarbons again. So, you know, there's more work to be done. But, you know, we have actually solved some problems. Don't forget we can do that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we do. Well, I think there must be thousands of books about the Arctic. That would be great for us. So I'll just go to the report that we did on Alaska. It's called Alaska Inuit Food Security, a Conceptual Framework of Assessing the Arctic. So you could just Google Alaska Food Security and the book should, or the report should come up. And the reason I suggest that is because there Alaska Inuit identify 58 drivers of food security and insecurity change, and a lot of them are related to climate change. But this can also give you a basic understanding of indigenous knowledge and some of the things that we were talking about. But another movie that you can watch is called The Angry Inuk, and you can just look that up too. And it's made by Inuit artists, and it's a really good movie to help you understand some of the positions that Inuit hold and why they hold them.
Thank you so much. Let's give another warm round of applause.